This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government.
Today is Dr. Mike Benera from the JLO. Dr. Benera, welcome.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
And we're going to talk about an issue that doesn't get talked about a lot kind of in more popular histories and more public-facing histories, but is a very important research and application both in general and where we are at the Command and General Staff College. And that's the officers who made up Napoleon's army and kind of how they got to where they were and what they did. On which Dr. Brenner is an expert, both from his graduate school work and since, and I also have some expertise. So we'll kind of transition to Dr. Nance hosting for most of this episode. Before we do that, I want to start, Dr. Brenner, by asking, who are these men? Who are the men who make up kind of the higher echelons of the officer corps of the Napoleonic armies?
They come from a variety of places, but the groupings are generally the same. Some of them are part of the nobility that get, they adapt to the revolution early and are able to leverage their existing education and stature to get elected to become officers. And once they get into the revolutionary armies, it's quite clear early on from their peers that these men have superior leadership capabilities and they began leading. Others of them were professional military. They're not nobles, but they're professional military, either officers or non-commissioned officers. And again, for some of the same reasons, in those early revolutionary armies when leaders and officers are elected, as egalitarian as the revolution is in the army, you still want your leaders to actually have some competence in order to not get you killed.
Right.
And so there's kind of a bifurcation there. Now, obviously, there are exceptions. Mm-hmm. But it all rotates around existing experience or competence that they leverage onto the battlefield.
So let's talk about a couple of examples. I think you hit the two main categories. The noble, who may have been an officer before the revolution, the enlisted person who then later becomes an officer, so we're thinking like maybe a Kellermann in the first category and a Massena in the second category. Then you have this weird third category, people like DeVue, who were nobles, but then became Jacobins, and then Napoleon elevated for no reason and then became very good. So these people, like, let's start with Kellermann, because he's somebody you've studied. And it's important to point out there are two Kellermanns. There's a father and a son. So the son was the subject of your research. We might call him today a Nepo baby. He looks like somebody who doesn't deserve his job. He's the son of a noble. That doesn't necessarily guarantee any competence. So what do you make of that Nepo baby idea, and who was he actually as a commander?
So François-Étienne Kellermann, the younger, he is noble, and of course he's the son of the hero of Valmy, you know, the savior of the revolution.
In 1792,
although, well, so at the beginning of his career, he's actually, he comes to the States as part of the diplomatic mission to Philadelphia, and so he speaks English. This will help him later on in his dealings with the English, because they don't know that he speaks English.
Right.
But, so he is on his way to developing some capabilities as a diplomat, and kind of a Renaissance man sort of figure. He comes, and he doesn't have to come back, but he comes back in the early days of the revolution, and I've become convinced that Kellermann the Younger is a real revolutionary. Mm-hmm. He believes the ideals of the revolution.
Somebody like a Pichegru then?
Absolutely. And he gets on the revolutionary team, although as the revolution begins cycling through violence and in-groups and out-groups, Kellerman, both elder and younger, are on the out-group for a period of the revolution. He spent some time in prison, and then emerges with enough revolutionary bona fides to rejoin the revolutionary armies in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. Before Napoleon reconstitutes the nobility and Kellerman, you know, gets re-elevated back into status.
So would you say that he deserves his position, or did he just get it because Daddy was somebody important?
Oh, no. He not only deserves it as, you know, attaining a certain level of competence on the battlefield, but he works extremely hard for a lot of years before he gets elevated to any sort of stature at all.
Yeah.
So one thing I want to kind of pull on here is we talked about leaders, but these are also commanders of armies. And if you've been around the military history for just a minute, command and leadership are very different things. So let's kind of tease apart the difference and then kind of dig into how does personality change? What kind of personality do you need as a leader versus a kind of personality you need as a commander? And talk about these guys. So what is the difference between, say, like leadership and command?
Well, part of it is structural. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could say on the battlefield there's far more leadership than command in the early part of the revolution. By the time Napoleon institutes the consulate, the amalgame has already occurred. So all of your volunteer veterans of the early revolutionary period are completely integrated with the professionals. You begin having a far more professional and regular French army.
Yeah, and what we're doing with the amalgame is we're taking old veteran professionals, volunteers, and conscripts and putting them all together.
Yes, and this is when you begin to get a more uniform presentation of the French army. In the beginning, you know, the army that fights at Valmy is functionally veteran professional formations under Kellerman that stand their ground because, of course, they're leavened with veterans and experience and whatnot. And yet by the time of Napoleon's exploits in Italy, it's a far more uniform formation.
With numbered regiments, and we're starting up the chain. Eventually Napoleon will create numbered divisions of corps.
And this gets to the aspect of command, right? Because the armies of the French Revolution begin to institute there is a lot of what we would call mission command happening on the front, but in support of that mission command or in allowing that mission command are becoming increasingly regularized orders, messengers, a whole command and control system, and again, all at the speed of horseback and some telegraph capabilities. Mm-hmm. So these things are not antithetical. They are required to complement each other. That the better your system of command, the more effective your mission command becomes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me
elaborate on that before we go any further. I think people need to understand something that Dr. Bonnera said that's very important. There is this kind of semaphore telegraph system, but by and large, messages are carried, you know, at the operational tactical level by hand, whether that's on horseback or walking. And what I've found is you generally find orders from Napoleon to Berthier, his chief of staff. You find orders from Berthier to corps commanders and sometimes lower. You don't find a lot of orders lower than that, which leads me to believe in most cases they were issued orally. And what we have to understand about these men, if we're talking corps, division, probably brigade commanders, and certainly lower, generally they're next to the units. And a corps is a big formation. It's a little different with the cavalry. So Murat is a kind of a different case. But the normal infantry corps commander, he's going to be circulating. And sometimes he's going to be leading. So I'll give you an example from the 1805 campaign. Massena, who's one of these people who came up through the ranks, he was an NCO. He's a marshal of 1805. Not only is he a marshal, he is capable of commanding an army independently. That's what he's doing in 1805. He's in Italy. So he gives orders to his corps commanders, and really their divisions in Italy. And then he goes and takes command of a company. And that company is the company doing the bridge crossing operation to get across the river where the Austrians are defending the line. So when you talk about command and leadership, I think you can maybe say it's phased. That may be a fair way to look at it. You issue your command orders, usually in person, and then you go do leadership. Now, if you're Napoleon, that's different. We're not talking about him.
Well, okay. Well, Napoleon, of course, the famous, it's the Bridget Lottie, where he you know, leads Napoleon, guys across the bridge.
Remember, Napoleon does do some of this in early, in 1796, but he doesn't generally do it afterwards, I think it's fair to say. Remember, he's only ever wounded twice, and those come very early.
So this, so what's interesting here is, because we're talking about kind of leadership, and most people, are the examples we're talking about are more on the field of battle, kind of picking up the rifle, picking up the flag, saying, follow me, and moving out and drawing fire. Mm-hmm. Whereas the command, as you're getting at, is the larger piece of how do I make all these bits and pieces connect.
Before the battle.
So interesting. So interestingly, what I'm, and one of the things that's kind of tugged at me a little bit is that through the Revolution, you hear about these guys that have come up through the ranks. A guy that was, Napoleon, of course, was a captain, an artillery captain of all things, right?
Although he was a noble, so that's, he's, he did, he's help in a different category.
But by the same token, is like, how do these guys go from direct small level leaders and within 10 years or in many cases less, commanding corps and field armies at what we would today do, recognize as the operational level of war? Mm-hmm. How do we get from direct leadership to commanding lots?
Well, I would say it's not an easy process. But one of the things I wanted to point out is, you know, a lot of these officers are serving for at war for 23 straight years, mm-hmm. right? The amount of time they spend at peace is minuscule compared to the amount of time they've spent in the field.
And that's essentially only the period between 1803 and 1805.
Right.
When they're drilling.
Right, when they are training formations. So I think early there are growing pains in getting used to that level of command. But honestly, there's, once you get past 1805, from 1805 to 1812, that, you know, all of the expansion has happened. Mm-hmm. Right, the marshalate is marshals, the corps commanders are corps commanders, and what you get honestly is this brigadier general level of commander who doesn't seem to be able to advance, mm-hmm. and they don't. Right, it's not until the very end of the empire. Right, the cavalry corps commanders at Waterloo were all brigadier generals 3 years earlier,
and it showed,
and it did show for both ways, right? They had less experience exercising that level of command, and they were far more aggressive than their older, more experienced marshal, you know, counterparts, who were risk averse and not aggressive. Mm-hmm. So when I read the accounts of 1814 and even the Waterloo campaign, it's this constant struggle between younger, more aggressive commanders wanting to fight and the older, you know, already established marshals not wanting to fight at all.
Yeah, and if we can drill into that, there's a couple things that are happening that are very important. One of them is, as Dr. Bonero pointed out, there's a winnowing process, right? And that winnowing happens in really in one of three ways. One of them is obvious. These guys are leading from the front. A lot of them will be killed. DeVue famously got the marshal's baton of two other generals who died before him, one in Italy, one in Saint-Domingue. So that's a major winnower. Another winnower is talent. A Massena can come up through the ranks very fast, and he literally came up through the ranks. He was an NCO, then he became a marshal, because he was very good at his job. And as you can imagine, this is a very personal style of leadership. So he's very charismatic. His soldiers love him. And one of the reasons they love him is he loots everywhere and everything. So they get rich under him. So it's both a positive and negative of in terms of competence, right? And one thing Napoleon is often faulted for, especially late in his career, is he's really bad at cashiering bad commanders or bad marshals in the case of Ney. And also, there's a political aspect to it, too. And that's especially true in the Revolution. Some of them were winnowed by the guillotine. Some of them were winnowed by being on the wrong side of politics, like a Pichegru or a Moreau, or even you can kind of argue a Hoche, all of whom were competent revolutionary generals, but they get on the wrong side of politics and are either killed or kind of shuffled off the scene. Moreau defects to Russia. I think he's killed at Borodino, somewhere in there.
Yes, yeah. I think so, yeah.
So that is also true under Napoleon, both positively and negatively. He gives his brothers a ton of power and authority that they don't necessarily deserve. Like Jerome, who's one of the three army commanders in 1812 and just quits because he's not good at it. He can't do what Napoleon needs him to do. So that goes all the way down to the lowest levels. Napoleon is famous for, after every battle, he'll walk around the battlefield and he'll ask the soldiers, not the NCOs or officers, he'll ask the soldiers who the best soldier is. And those people will get marked out for awards, money, titles, but also promotion. So he's good at kind of building this system that as you said, pushes people up to the brigadier level, but there's this weird kind of shield that happens above that level.
Well, and something struck me when you talked about Massena, he's very good at his job, and I kind of had to, and I mentally inserted jobs,
mm-hmm.
the plural in there, because being a very good platoon leader, well, the not platoon leaders this time, but being a very good captain,
yep.
is a substantially different job description than being a very good brigade commander, mm-hmm. division commander, or corps commander on. So where do we find these guys that just can translate from a micro tactical to maneuvering a group of 20,000 soldiers across a field?
Well, let me turn the question back on you. Where do you find them in World War II?
And in World War II, the interesting case is most of the people that are maneuvering at that echelon had been in the Army for 20, 30 years, and they'd been through the school system, so they may have been stuck. Dwight Eisenhower is famously a lieutenant colonel at the start of the war.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd been in the Army since the 19-teens. So he had all the training and the experience, he just didn't have the rank.
Well, that's the thing with Massena and Bernadotte and these folks who come up from the enlisted ranks, or Brune, I don't even, he was like a street thug, and then he joined the Army, yeah. So it's the same process, it's just more institutionalized with the PME today, or World War II. But again, it's competence. If you are a Massena, and remember, officer turnover is incredible in this kind of fighting, because colonels lead the colonel is out front of the regiment. He's the first person to contact the enemy. So there are lots of officer casualties, and if a Massena picks up a flag in the regiment and takes it forward, like, he's probably going to be the next colonel. And that's a pretty easy way to jump pretty quickly.
But again, it you know, goes back to, you hit the nail on the head, it goes back to the amount of time these officers spent on campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And, right, there's no significant change to the tactical regulations in the period.
Yep.
So that's 23 years of fighting the same system in the same way. Now, the implementation, there's plenty of innovation that happens out there. But honestly, it's, you know, the reconstitution of the French army after the War of 1812 is fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Napoleon, Kellerman the Elder is able to administratively get soldiers and horses and materiel to the front, and they reconstitute a 150,000 man army overnight, largely because the folks that absorb these recruits know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They've been doing this for 20 years.
I want to take that in just a little bit more, because it's not just the commander. Or it's not just the ability to point to know where to send a battalion or know how to fight a battalion. Okay, so I've got 100,000 new guys. That is obviously 100,000 new rifles or muskets. That's 100,000 new uniforms. That's 100,000 soldiers worth of rations daily. So the question then comes into is how do these guys... So, fighting the unit is almost the easy part for these guys. It's the how do they manage the sustainment and the overall larger piece of this?
Well, ironically enough, they aren't, right? Aside from local foraging, those corps commanders don't have to. This is the beautiful thing in the Napoleonic system. They don't have to worry about that stuff because there are administrative generals behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Kellerman the Elder spends the entire 20 years in the Napoleonic period being that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And all he does is build horse depots.
Yep.
And move those horse depots on the map. And he's constantly
like, he's like the
doing
MC commander.
Absolutely. No, absolutely.
If you find a map of a Napoleonic campaign, there will be a box with four X's on it that Kellerman is commanding. It's on a French border somewhere.
That's right. And he spends years and years doing this, you know, building depots, consolidating production from the capital. So that's kind of the, and he's not the only one, right? Like there are a number of these figures and a whole bureaucracy that's doing it. Mm-hmm. Berthier, you know, we talk about the exercise of command. Berthier is doing the same thing on the orders staff production for Napoleon, right? He's the one transmitting, you know, the Napoleon's thoughts and ideas into those actual orders to the corps commanders. Now, and I know, Dr. Abel, you hit on this in a number of ways. Napoleon, right, the real answer to how do you scale up is micromanagement. Mm-hmm. And you see far more micromanagement happening from Napoleon down. And the farther down you get, it's clear that that micromanagement is going down from the corps commanders down, down, down. So in 1810 and 1809, 1810, there's far less mission command going on than there had been a decade earlier. Mm-hmm. And this is both a strength and a weakness because it does allow you to project power across Europe, but it does stifle initiative. And so commanders who were far more aggressive and innovative in the 1790s are far less so in the 1800s.
And interestingly, I've had occasion to read Massena's memoirs, however much you believe them, and he did a lot of the same micromanaging when he was an independent army commander. So I think it's fair to say this is not personal to Napoleon. It's something endemic in the system. And this is a French thing. French doctrine has always been commander-centric. Even today, it's still relatively commander-centric, particularly compared to the German. And when we think of Berthier, his chief of staff, who was a long experienced officer, he fought in America. So by, you know, by 1813, Berthier's, 35 years experience?
Right.
He is not issuing orders. His staff is not generating, you know, courses of action for Napoleon to select from. He's just executing. This is actually the way you want it to work, because Napoleon is the genius, and you need things to filter down. Now, it's harder to say whether or not corps and division commanders are doing the same, because as I said, I believe most of those orders were issued orally. So it's really hard to say whether or not they had the same kind of sense of rigid control over their subordinates. I think it probably varied by commander. If you're Murat, you cannot do that with cavalry. They have to be able to execute independently. But if you're DeVue, who is famously disciplined, and he's called the Iron Marshal, he was disciplinarian to the point of criticism, probably did.
And the way those corps and division commanders got around this, of course, is these are existing regular formations. Mm-hmm. So these officers have history, like years of serving under each other. And so it's not micromanagement, but you can train your way to obedience, mm-hmm. and precise obedience at the division and below that you can't really get at the corps level.
It's also worth pointing out, it is frequent for Napoleonic commanders to take command of a lower echelon formation. And not only is it frequent, it's expected. I've never seen pushback from the lower echelon commander. There are instances where a corps commander will take command of a division or even a brigade and command it as if it's his own. And this is just expected. I think probably the idea is this guy, he's done what you've done. You know, unlike a modern military, most of these guys had commanded at most levels in combat, so that they get it. And I think there's also a sense of not necessarily the same social hierarchy you would see with the old nobility, but I do think when the marshal shows up, or when, you know, the general of division shows up, there's a sense among the soldiers that, like, this is a person and we're fighting for him now.
It's almost the noblesse oblige, where I'm here, so I will lead you from the front.
Yeah, to an extent, and I also think we need to be careful with modern sensibilities of nobility, right? I think we often have that Blackadder Douglas Haig view of nobles, that they're just sitting in the back, fat, in a chateau, while their soldiers are off dying. It's a very Marxist view of war. That is not true. A French noble's job is to die in combat. So, and they really believed that. And that's true, at least to some extent, of Napoleon's, what we call his notability. These commanders, like a Lannes or a Béziers, if they died in combat for Napoleon, that's kind of the end they hoped for.
So let's take this basic system before we go too much further. So let's take any campaign, any battle. You guys can pick the ones you like.
1805 is the easiest.
1805. So let's take an order from Napoleon all the way through to a corps commander down to units storming the Pratzen Heights or Davout attacking.
Well, you're working more closely yeah. than I have.
Yeah, so I've just been looking at this, and it's more or less what you'd expect. And there are two distinct parts of, well, in fairness, there are three distinct parts of this, right? As Dr. Benura mentioned, there's an 18-month-long process where you train. That's very tightly controlled. It's done in a series of camps along the Norman coast. And Napoleon's visiting. He's getting his units structured in the way he wants. Remember, the corps is new in 1803, 1804. So he has to teach his corps commanders how to use a corps, which most of them take to. And then he takes this army in 1805 on campaign. This is the operational phase.
So he's already laid out what we would call standard operational procedures and doctrine.
And spent probably 9 months having them conduct corps-on-corps simulated combats, including some live fire exercises. So it's not just him sitting in a cabin with these guys. He's actually walking them through the process on the field. And with linear warfare, you have to be in the field. You cannot do it as a sim. You have to know how to feel where the troops are. Then the second phase, the operational phase, is where the corps depart. This is where he's most frustrated and probably least effective, because he's constantly issuing orders, but those orders don't necessarily get through. When they do get through, they're often obsolete, and sometimes the commanders just ignore them. For good and bad reasons, right? He is immensely frustrated from the time between Ulm to Austerlitz, where he's trying to pin the Russians down. They're retreating too quickly. Murat keeps messing up, but you can't tightly control a cavalry corps, right? And then you get to the battle, and that's where he's able to stand next to all his corps commanders and order them to do what he wants. He can order the division commanders to do what he wants. Sometimes he goes lower. It's rare, but sometimes he orders brigadiers to do certain things.
And this is when you get, you know, one of the critical elements, I think, in Austerlitz is you get operational level deception. It's not feints in the way we would think about it, but the way he integrates Davout's corps into the battlefield in his mind ahead of time, it's not something you can do in a standard staff process of today. That really is operational genius. Mm-hmm. But he's only able to do it because, like Dr. Abel said, they're all there, and he has a reasonably short distance to send messages.
And he also says, I've read the order, he issues an order to Berthier, then issues it to the army. All of the corps commanders will meet with me in person 3 or 4 days before the battle. And they're on the battlefield for several days. He does a terrain walk with all of them, all the corps commanders. That's why Austerlitz is his masterpiece, because he had a chance to plan it.
So let's take this to the next year, 1806, the famous twin battles of Jena and Auerstadt.
Mm-hmm.
So talk me through the challenges there, particularly in relation to Bernadotte's corps, which seemed to spectacularly avoid being at either one. How did that go down?
Yeah, Bernadotte's a special case. Bernadotte is like Massena. He came up through the ranks. He was a sergeant, and then he became a marshal. I think the consensus is he got his baton because of political connections. We forget Bernadotte was kind of a rival to Napoleon during the Revolutionary era. He was the war minister at one point, so he kind of outranked Napoleon for some of that time.
Absolutely.
He has political connections to the royalists, which he later leverages onto the Swedish throne. His descendants are still there. So he's not necessarily a Davout or a Massena or even a Lannes, somebody who actually has proven himself at every level. He's a good fighter, but I'd say he probably peaked at division command.
Well, on the battlefield, yes, yeah. but his political machinations, right? Jump him up to stardom.
Yeah, so he's not necessarily the A-team, at least in terms of tactical operational level command. And what you've walked us through is, so in 1806, Napoleon moves north into Prussia, and he encounters, there's a couple encounter battles. He's trying to do the same operational level deception leading to decision at Jena, and it fails. There's a great Dennis Showalter quote that he marched into battle having issued orders to none of his corps, and like Ney just kind of did whatever he wanted. At one point, Ney advances without orders and they have to rescue him. He leaves Davout and Bernadotte out on his right without anything to do, and then Davout ends up fighting most of the Prussian army by himself. So it's a mess. As good as 1805 was, 1806 was bad. And we don't debit Napoleon for it because he won, but it was kind of a disaster that his subordinates rescued him from. I don't know if you agree with that.
No, absolutely. And the difference is it's not a set piece battle. It's a movement to contact in a way that Napoleon isn't able to exert specific control. I actually wanted to at this end of the concept, because in the David Chandler telling, there's this battalion carré, right? Which I find to be extraordinarily unpersuasive as a movement formation, not the least of which Napoleon never does it again.
Right. It's also, battalion carré is a joke. Battalion carré is how you exercise at the battalion level.
Right. So the idea that... Yeah, so really what this is they're attempting to make contact with the enemy. And Ney is an interesting example in this, because I have a little bit more sympathy for Ney, right? Ney is a hammer, and when you need a hammer, Ney is the perfect guy for the job. This is why he's, you know, the retreat from Russia is his masterpiece,
yeah.
Because it's all hammer all the time, right? There's no subtlety, there's no nuance. Right. So Napoleon's trying to come to grips with the Prussian army. Ney sees this, right? Ney gets over the heights into Jena. He sees the Prussian army, right? Like, that's what he goes and does. And he is out front, and it is going badly for him. That's how the, you know, and Napoleon only defeats, you know, a third of the Prussian army. And this is really Davout's time to shine. Mm-hmm. But again, right, as limited and chaotic as Jena is, Auerstadt, Davout runs Auerstadt like a well-oiled machine, mm-hmm. right? He sees the terrain. He understands. And having driven the Auerstadt terrain, there's not a whole lot of terrain on that terrain. But he finds the slight elevation. You know, he sets up on it. He leads the enemy into his engagement area. And it is the drill and discipline of the training of the last 2.5 years that really allows Davout to succeed.
It doesn't hurt that the Duke of Brunswick takes a musket ball in the opening stages.
The Prussians fight incompetently. I'm not sure Brunswick would have helped them. But
I was thinking the same thing.
It's more
God bless him.
It's more this is Blücher's worst hour. Blücher's the great Prussian commander. He helps defeat Napoleon later, but he just feeds his cavalry in by echelon, unsupported, into these squares. But it's also worth pointing out, Davout had probably the three best division commanders, what are often called the Immortal Three. And they stay with him for most of these campaigns, the 1805 to 1807 period. So he understands them, and they understand him. This is like, if people have seen Band of Brothers, it's the beginning, right, where they go through this kind of crucible of a terrible officer who actually does prepare them really well for war. But instead of a company, these are divisions. And the right. Three divisions that are incredibly well-trained, they're commanded by a person who, I don't think it's fair to say Davout is Napoleon's equal, but Davout understood Napoleonic warfare from the core level down. And he'd done most of it. He didn't come up through the ranks. He was never enlisted. Technically he might have been enlisted, but still. He started at the company level. So he understands at every level how to do this. He also understands that his division commanders know how to do it. So he doesn't have to micromanage somebody like a Goudin or a Friant. Those are his two of the three. He trusts them. And this is where you see, as much as we might call it mission command, this is where we really do see some of the mission command type stuff. It's a mutual trust born of long experience and, the most important part of mission command, great competence.
Yeah, which brings me to the question of, so we've been talking Ney, who is on a short leash with Napoleon. Well, reasonably short, at least. And you have Davout up in the north fighting the Battle of Auerstadt by himself.
Mm-hmm.
So Bernadotte is in between those two, and yet manages to appear at neither battle.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, this happens again at Waterloo, right? Like, and it's this is the extent of the effectiveness that horse messenger orders can do. It is hard to operationally maneuver a corps out of contact in any reasonably timely manner, mm-hmm. because when the orders get to him, you know, and it's exactly like Durand in Waterloo. When orders get to him, they've already been overcome by events, and he's following orders that no longer make sense. Mm-hmm. And this is why Bernadotte whipsaws back and forth to no avail, and is not present for either.
So there's a great example of mission command that I use in my classes. It's actually from Friedrich II of Prussia. He's fighting a battle, and he issues an order to his cavalry commander, a general named Seydlitz. And Seydlitz famously says, "You can have my head after the battle, but let me win it for you now." Seydlitz disobeys the order and wins the battle. So the good Napoleonic commanders, the Massenas, the Davouts, the Lannes, I think to a lesser extent the Soults, definitely the Suchets, they knew when to exercise what the British called disciplined disobedience. Napoleon would forgive Bernadotte for ignoring any written orders he had received and marching to the sound of the guns. That's kind of a standing order. Now, he would not forgive Bernadotte for not doing anything or for being incompetent. Remember, Bernadotte has that political anchor around him. So Napoleon can't just cashier him, although he will eventually. He will cashier him after the 1809 campaign, really for body of work, not for any one incident. But that is an example of a system that still is only as good as the people running it.
Which I want to hit on, which is we've been talking about these guys that are coming up through the school of hard knocks. But after a while, you kind of start to see the same names over and over again. So the question comes into... what is the system to make a Davout? Because Napoleon must realize that Davout is a one of, so how do I get close to or some measure of replacement for Davout?
No, and this is the great criticism of Napoleon, right? That he doesn't have a system to educate new generals to bring the young crop up. And it is a criticism, right? There's plenty of administrative work to be done in the empire to move these older marshals into, like Kellerman, mm-hmm. and invigorate a younger crop. Napoleon is uninterested in doing so. Mm-hmm. And then I think the problem is after 1812, there's no time to do so. Mm-hmm. That he's kind of, you know, he does pull. This is Kellerman the Younger. Kellerman the Younger is retired. He doesn't join the 1812 campaign because of his health, but in 1813 it's all hands on deck, and then he gets thrust into the high. You know, he becomes a corps commander of a Polish cavalry corps, which is another element to Napoleonic allied command. I'd like to talk about event. You know, soon.
Oh yeah.
So there is no system. There is no system to teach it. There's no system to develop it. There's not even a real plan to graduate these folks. Because how long can you keep a guy as a brigadier general being, you know, the same level before that guy begins thinking maybe a different profession is it's time for?
Well, and I think it's you made a good point earlier, Dr. Bonura. There is a system up to a point, right? The Napoleonic system, the Napoleonic state is very good at stamping out every level from junior NCO to brigade command. That's good, it's done, it's not particularly difficult to get those people in place because you have constant experience. It's the upper levels that cause him so much trouble. And it's worth remembering, from 1807 on, he's fighting a war in two different theaters. So he's splitting his efforts. This is why the Grand Armée of 1805 to 1807 is the best, because it's the most unified. Although there are two theaters there, but still. Spain soaks up a huge number of people who are capable of independent command because they have to be. Spain is essentially broken down into a series of viceroyalties. Those marshals and generals have to be capable of exercising independent command because Napoleon's not there. So that's where you see somebody like a Suchet shine. Suchet came up through the ranks. I think he was a brigade commander at Austerlitz. He goes to the top pretty quickly, but he's in Spain. So he is not commanding one of these corps in the 1813 campaign when Napoleon really needs him. And sometimes Napoleon shoves the, you know, the third rank folks, the Jourdans, out into Spain, but he also keeps a lot of people who are capable there. The one thing I would push back on, something both of you said, is this kind of American bias we have that age should dictate where your rank is. Some of the marshals needed to be shuffled off. Some of them needed to be given administrative tasks. I think you see that with Massena, who basically retires after his Spanish campaign, because he's old by that point. I mean, he's older than Napoleon. He's, you know, he's worn out. But the flip side of that is Davout never ceases to be effective throughout the entirety of the Napoleonic Wars. He chews up the Prussians in Paris after Napoleon abdicates. I think it's the second time. But Napoleon strands Davout in Hamburg for the 1813 campaign. No one knows why. No one knows why Napoleon thought putting him there instead of being an army commander was more important. He could have swapped his adopted son Eugene, army commander, for Davout, and probably done better in 1813.
Done better, but Eugene, and we've talked about this before, of all of Napoleon's family nepotism, Eugene is the one that has any real exerted any real competence.
Other than Caroline.
Other than Caroline, yeah, but but Caroline's utility is limited.
Yes.
Based on the sexism of the time.
Yes.
Yeah. No. Davout's in Hamburg, and Saint-Cyr is in. Where does he strand Saint-Cyr?
Is it up in Riga? Or
yes. Yeah, Riga or in the on the Baltic coast. These are right. Saint-Cyr is an up and comer, right? He's a sharp guy, and this is one of Napoleon's problems at, you know, in the middle to the end, where in the beginning he does an excellent job putting the right people in the right places to do the right thing. He does a horrible job at the end doing so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to come back to something you mentioned, and on that, so we're not just talking about French officers leading French formations at this point. The modern term would be a combined army at this point, not combined arms, a combined army, or a multinational
force. Multinational force, for sure.
So, first off, is he just using French officers? And second off, how does the multinational component tie into this glob of leadership and command we're dealing with?
Yeah, so right when you envision a multi-ethnic army, a multinational army failing, you immediately go to the Austro-Hungarian, right, the Ka-un-Ka army of you know, the early 20th century, and they had problems. The Napoleonic Empire army doesn't have those problems. And the reason is French is the language of both diplomacy, nobility, and education. Mm-hmm. So all of the foreign contingent officers, they all speak French. So you can have Kellerman, a Frenchman, commanding a Polish cavalry corps, not speaking any Polish at all, not having a problem commanding the corps. Mm-hmm. Now, he doesn't take commands of those, you know, he doesn't lead, you know, charges anymore, right? Where you will see him do that in 1814 back in France. The exercise of command is relatively seamless because they're issuing all these orders in French, and the orders are going relatively far down in French before they have to be translated into whatever the vernacular is to the units that are fighting.
I would say the balance is probably the officer, junior officer to NCO level. That's where you have to start translating to native. Worth pointing out, too, though, you have plenty of instances of a Kellerman commanding a Polish force, but you also have plenty of instances of natives commanding native forces, particularly Italians. I don't think it hurts that Napoleon is Italian. He can speak Italian, although it's Corsican Italian. And there's an affinity there that leads Italians to building and training and commanding their own units. Now, you don't see many of them used on the front line. Often they're used in secondary or tertiary theaters. Often they're used for rear area security, as we would call it. But you do definitely see, at least up to a certain level, native commanders commanding native forces. Like the Bavarians, great example.
Oh, yeah.
The Bavarians usually have a Bavarian, at very least, division commander, and sometimes you have this kind of dual system of command, or I think we would call it parallel now, where you have a native commander standing next to a French advisor.
Well, and I want to take that to the next piece, too, because one of the biggest challenges we have in multinational formations, you brought up World War II, is a great example of the British and the American armies. there is the national prerogatives and opinions that come into that. So the senior commander who is commanding both of these armies has to take into account the political considerations of formations that are not his own. So Eisenhower has to famously basically give up large amounts of combat power to clear the Jean d'Estuary because the French government, well, the claimed French government in 1944 is needing it for their own political purposes. Are there similar cases like this with Napoleon? I would assume since he's the emperor, he can kind of push past some of that.
Yeah, what you end up seeing is the military force commitment is part of the deal for political survival, right? So the Bavarians produce Bavarian contingents to retain control of Bavaria, and the German states are the same way. The Poles become, and to his credit, Napoleon really does bring the revolution east, right? He does, you know, create far more German unity than had been before. He creates the Duchy of Warsaw, right? So the Poles really hitch their wagon to Napoleon in this kind of great power conflict. So those national contingents are incredibly committed. Mm-hmm. And he makes, right, Poniatowski, he makes a marshal, albeit right at the
for
end.
For about 18
right?
hours.
But, right, he and those contingent commanders integrate relatively seamlessly with the French command system and the Napoleonic style of warfare.
So it's worth pointing out, as Dr. Minerva said at the beginning, the tactics and equipment are uniform. There are no differences of equipment or approach. Everybody, as Jomini famously says, all the regiments fight the same way in any given case. You can just roll open the doctrine manual, figure out what to do. And even the higher level command, as centralized as it sounds, the execution is often devolved into what we would call a mission command system. It's Napoleon does not so directly control lower levels of fighting during the fighting. It's before the fighting that he does his micromanaging.
So the Bavarians are not telling Napoleon, hey, you can only use our army in this and such a manner.
No.
And it's Dr. Minerva also said something very important in two things. One, they hitched their wagon to Napoleon, whether, you know, in some cases they wanted to or not. Bavarians, they were kind of all in from the beginning. Some of the places, what is sometimes called the Outer Empire, maybe less so. But the Poles also, they were all in because they wanted independence again. And they thought Napoleon would give it to them, and he did to some degree. But there's something else going on here that Dr. Minerva brought out that's really important, too. It's hard to underestimate how revolutionary the revolution was. When we talk about the French Revolution, we often think about, you know, guillotining people in the center of Paris. But what they were doing was bringing a series of advances to make people's lives better in most cases. I'll give you an example from Italy. When the French took over the Papal States in the late 1790s, they put in 15,000 street lamps in the city of Rome. They started draining the swamps around the city, which produced the famous Roman fever that the Gregory Peck movie is named after. So if you're somebody who has the benefit of French occupation, you might actually be benefiting from it. This is not the later kind of cynical, exploitative conquest, although there is an element of that. Napoleon and the French genuinely believed in bringing enlightenment to the places they were. And it's important not to see national contingents as being uniform. When Napoleon goes to Spain, the vast majority of the Spanish hate him and hate what he stands for, more than anything because he wants to take away their priests. But there are Spanish people who are all in on the revolution. They're called afrancesados. You find those anywhere. There are people who are frustrated by the old regime, who want to be able to write and say and think what they want, and maybe have a street lamp under which to see what they're writing. So Napoleon does actually bring positive good benefits to many of the places he goes. Now, the back end cost we can debate, but one of the things anti-Napoleon people often elide or outright ignore is that sometimes street level lifting of the average person.
So we've been, and there's a logic here behind going up to this level here, but what then happens with the Prussians who famously swap over? Mm-hmm. To the coalition as opposed to staying on Napoleon's side.
Oh, well, because they were defeated, right? It wasn't like they were oppressed and Napoleon liberated them. Mm-hmm. They were a vassal state and a much smaller vassal state under Napoleon than before. Mm-hmm. So in that case, it is not surprising at all that the Prussians, at the drop of a hat, would switch sides and join the coalition, because mm-hmm. they only have things to gain.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and the reason... Go ahead.
Well, let me add to that, too. There's a famous quote that we like to quote, and I don't know that anybody's ever figured out if it's actually true or not, but it's a good one. There's a Prussian general named York, and the Prussians figure out that they're going to have to be like the French in order to beat Napoleon. So they start instituting all these social and military reforms. And at one point, the king is contemplating abolishing nobility, which is the great thing that allowed the French to have this experienced army and officer corps. And this general goes to the king and says, if you abolish my nobility, on what does your throne rest? And so, yes, there are people who want to adopt the modernity of the French Revolution that Napoleon brings, but there are also a whole lot of people invested in the system the way it is. There are still monarchs regnant in the world today for reasons that you can't really articulate. There are very few people who can articulate a political reason why there's still a king of the United Kingdom. But we still have one, much less a king of Canada or Australia, which is also a thing. So, you know, as much as there are people who want to be the vanguard, there are also people who don't want change.
So the reason I kind of went up to this level is we've been talking about command and leadership. We start off with leadership, you know, grabbing the flag and leading the regiment forward, and we've been kind of steadily climbing up the levels of leadership and into command and a senior level command. So that's kind of where I want us to kind of put the cherry on top here, which is, how does Napoleon, or how do his first tier subordinates handle command at the national level? Do they do it well? What's your assessment? Do they do it well? Do they do it poorly? Is there any way they could have done it better?
Command at the national level. From a military perspective, what I'm thinking of is more military administration.
Yeah.
Right? And much of the empire is administered by military viceroy, for lack of a better word. This is Spain, you know, parts of Italy, Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And ironically enough, Napoleon's generals do a reasonable job of administering their provinces. Mm-hmm. The problem, and I'll tell you this, you know, Spain turns around when Napoleon stops funding it, right? When the generals in Spain have to make war pay for war, that's when they begin to engender a lot more resistance from the locals. I remember Soult goes in, you know, essentially buys his way into the ports, Oporto in northern Portugal, doesn't have to fire a shot. You know, wheels up the chests of gold or whatever, and the nobility there, the elites, they welcome him with open arms. You know, hey, this is great.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, they're not trained for it. They're not educated for it. So the performance does get variable, and they don't play well with others when they get into those positions, and this really hurts them in Spain.
Yeah, and I think that it varies, one, by personality. So Massena was pretty good at it, aside from looting everything. Massena was pretty good at it. Davout seemed pretty good at it. That's why he's later made Minister of War. And bear in mind, there's kind of two levels of this, right? There's the viceroy provincial command, and then there's the lower level kind of rear area security command. And that also varies by personality. So often Napoleon has these firemen that he throws into depot cities in his rear area and says to Berthier, send this general to Ulm. He is now in command. And his job is to do the Kellermann thing where he's pushing supplies and resources forward. So before I talk about some negative examples, the way this works is, it's a pairing of the French command and command authority with both civilian French experts and local experts. The local experts are incredibly important.
The fusion of the political and the military.
Right. So when you send somebody to one of the provinces of Spain, when you send them to Germany, when you send them to Eastern Europe in 1812, you expect them to plug into the military administration that's already there, that Berthier is running in the field as the chief of staff, that Clark is running as the minister of war for most of these campaigns. He's back in Paris. And that Napoleon himself is administering. Napoleon writes a lot of letters to people who are involved in supply, transport, governance, those kinds of things. And not just military, civilian as well, because he's also the civilian head of state. So he expects to throw them into a place with a military administration. He expects them to plug into the military, civilian, and local networks. DeVue is really good at this. What DeVue does is he goes to a place, he immediately creates a functional and efficient administration from the military side. Then he plugs into the local civilian networks. The supply networks, he has to contract for supply and transport. Even though it's nationalized on the French side, you still need local contractors. And DeVue is also really good at building what we would call a HUMINT network. Commanders were expected to build human intelligence networks in the AO they were assigned. And often they did that just simply with money. But sometimes they pulled on these, you know, sympathies. It's really easy, you know this, having been on occupation duty. You find the cleavages in the local society. You find, you know, the person who lost the last election or who has the grievance against the other farm family who owns the biggest farm. And you use those people. And so it's, as I said, it's kind of a union of all of these different things. You hold all of the elements of national power, as we would say. And that can be very local. It can be just the commander of a garrison city on campaign. There's a hilarious example of this with Jomini. So Jomini is a staff officer, first unofficially, then officially. He is tasked to be the garrison commander, I think, of Vilnius in 1812.
Yes.
There's this whole flurry of letters Napoleon sends to Berthier about it, and he commands the city for like 2 weeks. And he's so bad at it, Napoleon has to fire him. So it depends 100% on the competence of the officer sent. And the fact that Napoleon had to send Jomini to do it shows by 1812, things have expanded beyond the rational scope of C2 for Napoleon.
So let's kind of start putting this all together. So we have a very personality-based system here. And at a certain level, it's not even really a system, other than Napoleon's own, whatever's going on in his head. So with pluses and minuses, and it starts out and it seems to be most effective at the tactical command level. And as we start getting up and higher echelons, it starts to become very hit or miss. So for Dr. Abel, you and I have had these conversations a lot, typically over lunch and whatnot. So what lessons should the U.S. Army or the U.S. military, let's broaden it, pull from the Napoleonic system, or we can expand it to the revolutionary system as well.
So I would say, and I'll let Dr. Bonera have the last word, this is a personal affectation, this is no way the opinion of the U.S. Army, but what you said is very important. We are system thinkers. We model ourselves after a Prusso-German system in which there's a system. Our education system, our military promotion system is age-based for the most part. There is a better way. It should be competence-based. Now, understand I'm talking about a wartime system. Peacetime systems are very different. And one of the things that made the system work so well is it's always at war. You're always churning the bad ones out and the good ones up. So you have to acknowledge that no matter how good your system is, no matter how professional and regularized and excellent it is, which the U.S. Army's is, personality still matters. You must have the Napoleonic mesh of the system and the personality, what contemporaries would call coup d'oeil, the ability to look at a situation, figure out where the inflection points are, and then figure out how to leverage those to accomplish whatever mission it is that you have. And I think too often we fall into this Germanic, you know, factory ideal that we can just crank people through and every person will be equally competent at every job. We don't actually do that in practice, but that's still our guiding principle. And so I think that, in wartime, this is not for a peacetime army. In wartime, you have to empower the individual personality, and that will lead you to bad outcomes in some cases.
Yeah, I would say, you know, when the Napoleonic system was really working, there was a deliberate effort to match personality and person and job. And I would say that the army doesn't do that at all in any way, shape, or form. And it should, right? There should be an element of, and I also agree with Dr. Abel, that we say we are a systems organization and we function like a personality organization without any of the subsequent understanding or education about how to make that kind of personality system work. I think the U.S. Army would be incredibly well served to a far more focus on putting the right people in the right jobs at the right time. Now, that's what the talent-based marketplace says it's going to do. And again, there hasn't been any indication, as far as I can tell, that is happening at all. In fact, it may be the opposite, that allowing units and service members to have far more say, in fact, puts people farther away from the right person to the right job.
We need a Napoleon pushing them around.
We need someone, right? We need someone. So that's what I would say, right? Like, there's really no substitute. Again, the pinnacle of Napoleonic operational art rests on this incredibly well-trained and highly experienced, and in, you know, the history notwithstanding, a relatively cohesive officer corps, especially when Napoleon is present. When Napoleon is present, everybody gets along great. It's like they're best friends. You know, when Napoleon is 1,000 miles away, things get trickier. But yeah, I would say that would be the big takeaway, that, you know, there is a real genius to picking the right person for the right job at the right time.
And it is always contextual. You cannot copy a system from one culture to another, from one country to another, despite what we often try to do in multinational forces. There is also no right answer. It is impossible to get this right, I would say even 70% of the time. It is what it is. The benefit of a wartime military is you have the winnowing process, whether physically or institutionally, to where you can make the hard choices easily without having to worry about things like people's pensions and their careers, which you do and you must in a volunteer peacetime army. I would also say conscription makes a lot of this a lot easier. When you can conscript what you need for the military, including officers, this formula is much, much simpler.
So what you're both here getting at is system is important, but there is that personality touch that must be always present, and that is, of course, the hardest piece.
Well, and again, it doesn't have to be present, but if you're gonna have systems and personalities, you have to take them both into account. And that's one thing I think the Army is not doing very well. We talk all systems, we talk very little personality.
Yeah, and this is one of the major themes of Clausewitz. Never forget the human. Until we have a robot army, we have humans, and we need to take that into account. Again, personal opinion. All right, Dr. Benner, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.